this hour, we will talk with the author of National Insecurity, American Leadership in an Age of Fear. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest will talk about the lasting effects of 9/11, the mistakes that were made under both President Bush and President Obama in the years since, and where we are right now. What is the way forward? And we want to know from you, do you feel vulnerability and fear? Do you think President Obama is on the right track when it comes to national security issues? Why or why not? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let me welcome our guest. David Rothkopf is CEO and editor of the Foreign Policy Group. He is also a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He served as Deputy Undersecretary of Commerce for International Trade Policy during the Clinton administration. And he is the author of National Insecurity, American Leadership in an Age of Fear. Good morning.
Morning.
So why do you say we're living in an age of fear?
Well, you know, I think as we look back at the past, you know, year since 9/11, we saw a country that was shocked first by the act, then shocked into overreaction in Iraq. And then, you know, there were these kind of cascading consequences of that. There was more hatred. There was more terror threats out there. We became more vulnerable, I think, as a nation. I think seeing, devastation in the middle of Manhattan, live on television, everybody touched by it, not an experience we had before. Some politicians tried to respond to that in a way that actually produced more fear. I think we played into the hands of the terrorists, if you will. We embraced terror. And then, you know, even 8 years later, the reaction that we had against the mistakes made during the Bush administration led to a kind of a swing in the other direction that went too far. We began to tackle things less effectively, and all of a sudden today there's more terrorists committing more acts of terror with more casualties than ever before, and that vulnerability manifests itself in other ways. Look at the Ebola outbreak and the kind of crisis that occurred in America, even though the threat was really quite small.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the major missteps of the Bush administration after 9/11.
Well, I think the first couple of weeks after 9/11, everybody was shocked, and you had a period, kind of a grace period, where the world was united, the country was united, and I think any president of the United States would have responded by trying to figure out who did it and go after them. But very shortly thereafter, some people in the Bush administration started saying, well, you know, there could have been connections between these guys and Saddam Hussein, and they had unfinished business with Saddam Hussein themselves, and they started going after that, and we started seeing threats everywhere. And I think if there was one sort of fundamental error, it was that we saw a couple of dozen people commit an act that produced devastation in the middle of a big American city. And we followed that through logically and said, well, what if those people had a nuclear weapon? What if just one person had a nuclear weapon or a biological weapon? How could that affect us? And all of a sudden, when you follow that logic, everybody in the world is a potential threat. And, you know, you can't run a country that way. You know, you can't view every person on the planet as a potential threat. But we did. We treated a very small group of terrorists. At the time of 9/11, there were 100 members of core al-Qaeda by intelligence estimate. But we treated them like they were the Soviet Union, which was an existential threat. We reorganized our whole national security policy around addressing this very limited threat. And the only reason that you could think that we could do that was that we overreacted, that we overestimated the threat because of the emotional impact it had on us.
Yeah, and then you wrote that in response of George W. Bush's administration entering into the long, costly wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, remaking U.S. national security policy around the terrorism threat, that led to a backlash that ushered Obama into office with a perceived mandate to undo what his predecessor had done and avoid making similar mistakes. But then you go on to say the problem is, in seeking to sidestep the pitfalls that plagued Bush, Obama inadvertently created his own. Like what?
Well, you know, we pulled out of Iraq very quickly when they started talking about the status of forces agreement in a difficult way. The White House sent a message to negotiators saying, okay, we're done. We got out. We didn't stabilize the country in the way that it needed to. We didn't sort of stay involved in finding representations for Sunnis in Iraq, and that created an opening for ISIS. We didn't respond to the threat in Syria in any constructive way. I'm not saying there was a solution to Syria, but could we have created humanitarian corridors? Could we have put more pressure on Assad? Could we have put more pressure on our allies to stop funding extremists? Could we have actually armed some of the people in the Free Syrian Army that people in the administration, like Hillary Clinton and David Petraeus and others, thought ought to have been armed? Would that have had an effect 3 years ago when ISIS was still essentially a street gang? Yes, it would have. Could we have responded more strongly to Vladimir Putin so that he wouldn't have continued forward in the direction that he did? Yes. Doesn't mean we have to go and recapitulate the errors of the Bush administration. We don't have to get into the wrong war in the wrong place in the wrong way. But there is a need for American leadership, and we pulled so far back that we stopped actually fulfilling that role.
So the Bush administration overreacted and the Obama administration is underreacting?
I think for the most part that's right. And I think the tragic irony is that the signal event or consequence of Bush overreaction is a war in Iraq. And the signal consequence of Obama underreaction is a war in Iraq. That's a tragic irony, but it's one that's playing out on our television screens right now.
Yeah. So how should Obama have handled Syria?
Well, as I said, I think there were a series of things that we could have done and should have done 3 years ago that would have had the effect of diminishing the risk associated with ISIS. I think there were a number of things that we could have done and should have done that would have had the effect of diminishing the vulnerability of Iraq. I think in the case of Iraq, leaving some troops behind, but more importantly, remaining engaged with the Iraqi government to focus on creating a true representative government would have been very helpful in creating a kind of a counterforce among the Sunnis. I think in the case of Syria, you know, we had allies like Qatar and Turkey who were actually funding and supporting extremist groups there. We could have put pressure on them to stop. We could have stopped undertaken steps, whether it was a no-fly zone or humanitarian corridors, where we helped diminish the humanitarian costs of this thing. We could have put pressure on the Russians and the Iranians. We're in the middle of a negotiation with Iran right now regarding getting a transition away from Assad, which is a key problem there and shouldn't be minimized. And we could have when we said we were going to arm and support and train the Free Syrian Army, we could have actually done it, which we didn't. We dragged our feet in those cases. I'm not saying you would have had a perfect outcome. I am saying I think you would have had a better outcome than we have right now.
Yeah. So what do you see happening when it comes to, you know, the debate over boots on the ground to combat ISIS?
Well, I mean, I think the question is not whether you need boots on the ground. I think the question is whose boots are going to be on the ground. And right now there aren't many people in this coalition that we've put together who are willing to do that. So what you've got is an Iraqi army, which is actually being advised very closely and guided by the Iranians, and which is not terribly well-trained or effective. So that's not an optimal choice to do all of the work we want to have done. You've got a very fragmented Free Syrian Army. You've got some effective fighting going on from the Kurds, but I think it is going to take some coordinating, advising mechanisms. And I don't know anybody that I've spoken to in the U.S. military that doesn't think that sooner or later U.S. special forces, U.S. troops are going to have to be placed with these Kurds or with the Iraqis or with others to help ensure air coordination, ensure the right kind of intelligence is going to the right places, and help us target ISIS leadership and get to them. And that's just something that needs to be done. You can't play whack-a-mole in the desert with airstrikes against a group like ISIS and expect to make real progress. If you strike them, you've got to move in, ensure that they're out of the way, and then you've got to follow up politically with some kind of effective institutional structure that guarantees the place is not going to fall back into ISIS hands the minute you turn your back and leave.
So how insecure are we when it comes to our national security?
Well, I mean, we're the richest, most powerful country in the world. If we decide to use the resources that we've got, or if we use diplomacy in the right way to send the message that we are willing and capable to do that, I think we needn't feel that insecure. Having said that, I think as a country, we're still pretty skittish. Ebola was one example of the skittishness. If there were another attack on the United States or on U.S. people, I think you would see that as an example of our skittishness. And I think we have to move past it. If you look at countries that have lived with terror threats for a long time, whether it's Colombia or Sri Lanka or Israel or others, they harden their assets. People, play a vigilant role. They use police and intelligence to go after bad actors, but they don't reorganize their societies around combating terror, because that is playing directly into the hands of the terrorists. That is letting terror start to dictate the situation. And it's my hope that we are having swung in one direction and swung in another direction, that perhaps over the course of the next couple of years, that we will come out of this and get to a more reasonable, balanced footing.
So will the election results, the GOP, the Republican sweep, and the Senate control by Republicans make any difference when it comes to these foreign policy strategies?
Well, in terms of a lot of foreign policy things, it can make a difference, and it can make a difference in several ways. The Republicans tend to be more supportive of trade deals, for example, than Democrats. I was a trade official in the Clinton administration. It was always a source of some frustration that our own party was really an obstacle in a number of these deals. And so, you have things like the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement, which the Obama administration wants to put through, and a Republican Senate, Republican House are much more likely to be positively disposed in that regard. They clearly are likely to be more positively disposed on things like funding the intelligence community or funding the military. I think they can be a real problem for this administration when it comes to things like an Iran nuclear deal, where if they feel that it is not strong enough or the president's lifting sanctions too quickly, they can work to impose new sanctions. They can create obstacles. And, of course, they do have subpoena power. And if something goes wrong or they want to look back into something else, you can see Republican-led Senate, Republican-led House putting a lot of pressure on the president. Finally, of course, they control the checkbook. And so, the president has frequently in the past couple of years said things like, we want to launch a program for training people to help us fight terrorism around the world, and I seek $5 billion from the Congress. Well, that means the program is entirely beholden to whether the Congress wants to write the check.
We are talking about our national security, or our national insecurity. Our guest is the author of National Insecurity, American Leadership in an Age of Fear. And we're talking about the national security foreign policy mistakes made under both Presidents Bush and Obama in the years since 9/11. And so the way forward from here, we'll get more into that. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with David Rothkopf. He is CEO and editor of the Foreign Policy Group and author of National Insecurity, American Leadership in an Age of Fear. He says that the U.S. is experiencing high levels of vulnerability and fear when it comes to making foreign policy decisions. He says that there has been lasting effects of 9/11 based on mistakes made under both President Bush and President Obama. And we are talking about those mistakes and the state of our national security and where do we go from here? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. We were talking about the fear that Americans felt since 9/11 and maybe the vulnerability. But how real is that that vulnerability, David Rothkopf?
Well, look, we're still vulnerable to terrorist attacks. We were vulnerable to terrorist attacks before 9/11. There were terrorist attacks before 9/11. We will remain vulnerable. It's impossible to 100% harden the assets of a country, and therefore I think we have to expect that these kind of things will happen again. We are especially vulnerable to some kinds of more serious attacks on the WMD side, bioterror attacks, and or chemical attacks, especially. Those are things that we have to take seriously. I don't think people should be changing their lifestyle based on those things. I don't think that the government should be focusing on them to the exclusion of other things. I think we need to have an aspirational foreign policy that talks about how do we produce peace and how do we produce prosperity in the world. And long-term relations with major powers like China or Europe are much more important than these secondary issues. We also, by the way, face other kinds of threats that that are growing more serious. Cyber threats, I think, will affect far more people over the course of the next several years than some of these more traditional kinds of terror attacks. And by the way, one of the ways that we see our overreaction, one of the ways that we see a manifestation of kind of the level of vulnerability that we've got in the country, is the overreaching of the National Security Agency and the listening in on hundreds of millions of phone calls, and in some cases all the phone calls in a particular country, and the sort of setting aside fundamental civil liberties like those associated with the Fourth Amendment, because we feel that it is so important that we look into everybody's, email or social traffic because one of them might be a terrorist, and seem to say this is, such a unique circumstance that things like due process and the protection of privacy rights of people needs to be set aside. And of course, in my view, they don't. Those are the reasons we have the country. They have been things that have been protected since the founding of the country, and I think it is a sign of our sort of altered and kind of distorted perspective over the past several years that we've been willing to suspend those rights.
Christine in Southwest Wisconsin is with us. Hi, Christine.
Hi.
Yes, go ahead, please.
I haven't honestly been listening to the radio show for terribly too long. I just got in my car, but I heard the statement that us as America is more vulnerable after 9/11. And I have to really strongly disagree with that. I personally feel like after that happened, that kind of got rid of that imaginary bubble, like nothing could ever happen to us. And so now the American people know that those things could possibly happen, and they can be more ready for that instead of kind of, pretending like that's something that only happens in Europe or Syria or something like that, and realize that we don't only have to rely on the government to protect us, that there's things that we can do to protect us. Mm-hmm. And so I feel a lot of people now can have an attitude of that they're able to stand for themselves now too, and for their community, instead of having an individualist attitude, we have more of a community attitude and looking out for everybody else.
All right, so it was a shocker. We didn't think it was going to happen like that here, but now we know, and we can protect ourselves to a better extent. David?
Look, I think that's a very sensible attitude, and I think if it was more broadly held, we'd be better off. I think that 9/11 should have been a wake-up call, and I think we have taken some steps to improve our protections, to be more vigilant. People are more aware of what they should be looking for, and I think all those things reduce our risk and are sensible. That doesn't mean, however, that we haven't been acting, and our political leaders have not been acting in a way that has been fueled by a sense of vulnerability. And, you can see it even as recently as this last election campaign. There were literally hundreds and hundreds of ads run across the country that talked about the threat posed by ISIS or the threat posed by Ebola, and said, the president is making us dramatically, more at risk. I'm critical of some of the things that the president has done in terms of foreign policy, but the level of the threat to the United States has not changed very dramatically. We just tend to be very open to being buffeted by fear mongering because of the nature of the media, because of the nature of our dysfunctional politics, and because people still do bear this kind of open wound inside and sometimes allow themselves to be exploited.
Linda on Facebook says, it has always been a scary world, but we don't need false fear leading us as it has been up to the election. So there she's kind of making the point you were just making. I would bet you will hear very little about Ebola now that the elections are over, and I bet you the gas prices will start to go up also. Well, what about that?
I think you probably won't hear as much about Ebola because I think the threat has been contained fairly well. You will hear, you should hear, or you should try to hear about it in Africa because it's a very serious problem in Africa. But I think, again, Ebola was kind of a wake-up call about our public health system, and I think it's going to respond to these kind of threats better now. As far as the gas prices, this is kind of a mysterious issue. We have war across the Middle East. Historically, you would have thought that would produce higher gas prices. But because of some economic conditions, because of U.S. Energy production, for a variety of other reasons, we are now seeing war across the Middle East and gas prices plummeting. That may have one domestic effect, which I think your listener was getting at. It's going to be a little easier for consumers here in the United States. It's got other effects. I think Vladimir Putin looks at falling gas prices as a catastrophe for a Russian economy that's very weak. I think the Saudi government is starting to get nervous that they're not going to be able to, provide their people with some of the subsidies that help produce stability in that country. I think it's a double-edged sword, and I think we have to watch it very carefully.
Craig in Onalaska is with us. Hello, Craig.
Good morning. Your guest has touched on it, but my question is, there was a lot of fear-mongering by the Republicans during this past election in regards to the border and also Ebola coming across, terrorists coming across. What I'm wondering, will this play into the president's hand as far as pushing an immigration bill? Because if the Republicans fight him on immigration and border protection, they're going against what they argued.
Well, the president has said that in the wake of the election that he was going to go and institute some immigration reforms. I think, these are long overdue. But I don't think politically this is a very clear-cut picture. George W. Bush, who we need to stipulate did a lot of things wrong in foreign policy, was a fairly active supporter of immigration reform, and the moderate wing of the Republican Party has been a fairly active supporter of that. Meanwhile, Barack Obama, in his first term in office, deported twice as many people as did George W. Bush in 8 years in office. So the record of the Obama administration in terms of the enforcement of immigration laws has actually not been consistent with, I think, the overall view within the Democratic Party that reform is needed, and we need to come up with some way to deal with these millions of people who are here now illegally and integrate them into society in some way. My guess is that there will probably be, for all of the above reasons, some progress on immigration in the next couple of years. There needs to be, and from a purely pragmatic point of view, both parties want Latino voters in 2016, and neither is going to want to be seen as alienating that group. So my guess is, for very self-interested political reasons, you'll see some progress.
All right, next we will go to Steve in Madison. Hello, Steve.
Yeah, good morning. Good morning. Kind of a two-part question here. The author's seen James Risen's recent book also, which notes that the manufacture of fear and the growth of the insecurity is a wonderful growth industry for everyone who is profiting from it. And I'm wondering what he thinks about that and its progress into the throughout the 21st century. And also, he's kind of alluded to it, but I'm wondering whether in light of the various warnings that came in on possible attacks in the summer of 2011, where he places himself on the spectrum of those who wonder whether or not the Bush-Cheney administration allowed, at least, the 9/11 attacks to occur.
We don't usually go there, but I mean, there that theory is still out there that that they allowed it to happen, or they were maybe even involved. What do you say to 9/11 truthers?
Well, candidly, I try not to talk to 9/11 truthers that much. It's just crazy. I have respect for a big open debate on issues where there are facts behind them, and recognize that people can have a wide range of views. But the Bush administration can be faulted for not moving fast enough with regard to certain threats, for a broken process that was looking in another direction when it came to these threats, perhaps not having taken the Osama bin Laden threat as seriously as they should have, since the red flag only sort of came up for them a few weeks before the attack. But they didn't let it happen. Nobody had an interest in letting this happen. It was a catastrophe, and it struck everybody in the White House as just that, as a gut blow, as a horrific event. And so I think it's unfair and unconstructive to speculate like that. As far as the earlier point, though, that, you know, there are people who profit from this insecurity, that's always been the case since the dawn of time. There have been war profiteers, and there is a massive industry in the United States that has managed to keep the United States on a kind of a defensive or war footing since the Second World War. You know, after the Second World War, there was a big concern that we would kind of, you know, turn off the factories and the U.S. economy would collapse after having spun it up in order to win the war. And it never happened. It didn't happen because of the Cold War. And then after the Cold War, it didn't happen because we saw other rising threats, be it terrorist threat or the threat of China. And today we spend more than the next, you know, depending on how you're counting, 12, 13, 14, 15 countries in the world added up. On defense, which is ludicrous, particularly when you consider that of those countries, almost all of them are allies of ours, so their investments are things that we would benefit from. That doesn't mean people aren't out there taking advantage of it and pushing it, and I think James Risen is a distinguished reporter, and he writes about this in terms of a variety of areas, including the cyber area. We're now seeing, you know, new spending pushes in those areas, which we as a country really probably ought to think twice about, because we haven't invested in infrastructure, we don't invest enough in education, we don't invest enough in healthcare, we don't invest enough in research and development. And so every dollar that goes into an unnecessary defense program ends up taking a dollar away from some program that might benefit our children or our grandchildren more And so I think a reprioritizing is a good idea, you know, hopefully that will come again as the sort of age of fear ebbs.
We've been talking about the mistakes that that Bush and Obama have made, but you say that some things were done right since 9/11 when it comes to foreign policy. What did Bush do right?
Well, you know, first of all, you know, George Bush is not going down in any book as a great foreign policy president, either, for that matter, as Barack Obama. George Bush's first term was calamitous in terms of foreign policy, and the invasion of Iraq, I think, will go down in history books written by objective historians as a big mistake. But George W. Bush did have one quality that you want to look for in a leader, and that is that as he got into his second term, he recognized that things weren't going well, and he was able to stop and say, we need to change. And he instituted very broad changes. I spoke to Steve Adley, who was his second-term National Security Advisor, and he said at one point he sat with Bush in the Oval Office going over results from Iraq, and Bush said, our strategy isn't working, is it? And Hadley said, no, sir, it's not. And Bush said, well, then get me another strategy. And, you know, that's what he did. He pushed back on Cheney's role. He replaced Rumsfeld with Bob Gates. He moved Condoleezza Rice from National Security Advisor to State. He promoted Steve Hadley. He brought in a new chief of staff, Josh Bolton. He brought in a new Secretary of the Treasury, Hank Paulson, who took the lead on China and played a critical role in the financial crisis. And he embraced a new group of military leaders, which led to the surge, which led to a change in the way we fought terrorism, to the kind of light footprint techniques, you know, covert and drones and special ops that Barack Obama has subsequently utilized. He undertook a new kind of outreach in the developing world. You know, if you look at George Bush's record in Africa, Africa specialists, liberal Democrat Africa specialists, consider George Bush, particularly in his second term, to have had the strongest record of any American president there. PEPFAR was an important program to fight AIDS. The Millennium Challenge Corporation was a big deal. We had the Indian nuclear deal. We improved relations with other emerging markets, with the Europeans, began a deal to work with the Israelis and the Palestinians. It was a sea change. In the last couple of years of the Bush administration, foreign policy was working better. We were getting better results in Iraq and better results in Afghanistan. And that ability to change, to admit when you're wrong, is a critical skill and capability in a president. And, you know, I think it comes from who Bush was. Bush had made a lot of mistakes in his life. He hadn't been a successful businessman. He lost when he ran for Congress. He had, you know, he'd struggled even as a baseball team owner. He'd had problems with alcohol. And he would never have gotten ahead in life if he wasn't able periodically to stop and say, no, this has got to be changed. Mm-hmm. Barack Obama has not shown the same kind of growth in office. He has not shown the same kind of willingness. For all of his many strengths as a person, his intelligence, his earnestness, his hard work, he has not shown the ability to stop and say, you know, I was wrong here. I need to fix that. I need to reshuffle my team and strengthen them. In fact, his team, from the first term to the second term, has gotten weaker, more inbred, more composed of campaign people and yes people. It is not the team of rivals approach that he had in the first term. And, you know, you see the books that are produced by that team of rivals, which have been quite critical, and you would think that would be a wake-up call to him, that even his own team is saying you got to fix something, and yet that hasn't happened.
We'll talk about the way forward and take more of your calls as we continue our conversation with David Rothkopf. He is the author of National Insecurity, American Leadership in an Age of Fear. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking about our national insecurity. and welcoming your questions for our guest, David Rothkopf, who is CEO and editor of the Foreign Policy Group. He also is a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, served as Deputy Undersecretary of Commerce for International Trade Policy during the Clinton administration, and author of the new book, National Insecurity, American Leadership in an Age of Fear. More calls now. John in Madison is with us next. Hello, John.
Oh, yes. It was my understanding that President Obama could not get a good agreement with Maliki that kept our troops safe if they stayed in Iraq. And that's why we essentially moved out. And I'm wondering, could he have been tougher with Maliki early on?
David?
You're right that when they began the discussion on the status of forces agreement, Maliki pushed back. But there were many people in the administration with whom I spoke who felt that was a negotiating ploy, and that the appropriate step for the United States was to come back at him and take the negotiation to the next stage, and that's what Maliki expected, that this was essentially haggling. But the word came from the White House and from political folks, particularly within the White House, that essentially said, look, we do not want to push this. We want to get out. We were elected to, get out of Iraq. Let's just, if they don't want to, have a conversation, let's just get up and go. There's a conflict within the story. But I think that, this people I spoke to, the senior level people, felt there was a deal to be done there, and the administration didn't really put their shoulder to the wheel to get to that deal. That aside, your other point is absolutely right. Maliki received a lot of support from us in a variety of different ways, and we stopped riding him, stopped pressuring him, didn't use the tools at our disposal to ensure that the Iraqi government was actually more representative of all the people within Iraq, addressed the problems that were seen as potential threats, like the underrepresentation of Sunnis, address other kinds of problems, including corruption, closeness of Maliki to the Iranians, other kinds of things, and Shia favoritism. And so the result was, as a result of lack of attention to this thing, that the situation deteriorated. And this created an opening for extremist groups like ISIS to go into Sunni territories and say, Baghdad, doesn't care about you, doesn't represent you, is taking advantage of you. We share a common cultural heritage. We will do better by you. And it wasn't just a political, entry into these towns. They also said, we'll kill people who don't agree with us, and we're extremely brutal. But that combination of things laid the groundwork for this kind of change. It also brought a number of people who had formerly been Ba'athists and in the Iraqi army over into ISIS because they had a bone to pick with the Baghdad regime, and they saw this as an opportunity to do that.
Let's go next to Saeed in Brookfield. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, Joe. Hi, Dave.
Yes.
I have a comment and a question, and my comment is that in general, what I've been observing for the past 15 to 20 years, or even longer than that, our politics are really ruled by management, a lot of management style rather than leadership style. And an example I give you is just a topic that we're talking about, that how we have been so occupied by this, external terrorist threat to the country and all the resources and the wars that we have engaged in, as compared to a very existential, threat right here in the country, which I say drugs is, to me, is the bigger terrorist, and is affecting our everyday life and lives of tens of thousands of people every day being victimized by crime. And even the media is not nearly as focused on a topic like that, as opposed to a topic which is attractive and sexy like terrorism, or the potential possibility of another terrorist attack on the country.
Yes, yeah, Saeed, let me and make sure
I don't know if you're...
Saeed, may I ask you? I just want to make sure I understand. You're saying that there's been too much attention on the war on terrorism and we're neglecting the war on crime, the war on drugs, which is more of a threat.
Absolutely. I think the media does focus on topics that are more headline-making and compared to, you know, as I said, like the drugs to me and war on drug and, you know, this is something that we should be able to a lot easier, control that a lot easier than, again, the minds and, you know, the groups outside of this country overseas in, you know, Middle East or possibly Europe or other parts where, you know, we have the drugs right here that is coming mostly from Mexico and a lot of it is even produced in this country. And tens of thousands of people are being victimized by it every year. And
I get it. I get it. Let me get our guest to comment on that first. We have bigger threats here at home than terrorism, including drugs and crime, David.
Well, look, of course we have bigger threats here at home, and drugs and crime are threats. I don't think they're the biggest threats. I think growing inequality in the U.S. economy is a bigger threat than coming out of 14 years of seeing top-line GDP growth and productivity growth, but for the first time in U.S. history, not having that accompanied by real job or wage growth. That's very worrisome because it's producing a more divided society. That 90% of the benefits of the last recovery have gone to the top 10% of the population, and that the bottom parts of the population are falling behind, that 50% of or more of inner-city minority students don't graduate from high school and thus will never be part of American society. That is a fundamental threat to our society, that our, you know, economy is imbalanced, that we're not investing in infrastructure. That's a threat. Climate issues are a threat. Education issues are a threat. The fact that we have an aging society and a healthcare system that has yet to figure out how to address $70 trillion in unfunded health liabilities, that's a bigger threat. All of these things are bigger threats. There was another component of the question, mm-hmm. though, and that is, does management matter? And, you know, the U.S. government's the biggest, most complicated organization on the planet Earth. And we regularly elect people to senior positions in it that have no foreign policy experience. Five out of the last six presidents had none. And in this particular case, we've elected a guy to be president who has zero management experience. We usually will, you know, find somebody who was a governor or somebody who's run a big organization. But that is not the case here. And, you know, we sort of shrug it off. You know, in Washington, there's this kind of mistaken belief that if somebody can articulate something, that means they can actually get it done. Well, that's just not true. You know, you actually have to know the levers. You've got to be able to manage the system. You've got to know that the secret to managing is actually empowering those around you and not simply turning to a small group of people. That you got to know in a world that faces as many problems as we do in foreign policy, and we can make a long list of them, that that you need to use the whole of the U.S. government to be able to manage them on a daily basis. We are not doing that. So we got our priorities wrong, and we're not focusing enough on using the resources we've got and managing them well. And, of course, that's a very bad combination.
So you're at the table with President Obama and his advisors. What do you advise?
Well, I advise tackling the management issue first. I think that, you know, you need to strengthen the foreign policy team. A lot of presidents have made changes in their second term in their team, and I think I would advise that some changes be made here to get to people who are more strategic, who are better managers, who will provide him with a greater range of thoughts. I think that, you know, the president himself is going to need to be actively involved, whether it's in, you know, getting the Congress to go along with an Iran nuclear deal if there is one, or actually getting this coalition to produce the kinds of on-the-ground support that we're going to need, or getting the Europeans to line up against a much tougher position on Vladimir Putin, or actually ensuring that we shift our focus to Asia, as the president promised to do in the first term but hasn't followed through on now, et cetera, et cetera. So I think presidential leadership here is very key. I think having, you know, sort of kind of a house cleaning and improving the way that the team works in Washington is key. And I think being more strategic. You know, fighting ISIS is important. We must eliminate ISIS. We can't have an extremist state in the middle of the region. But the bigger problem is fighting extremism. And the way that you fight extremism, first of all, is you see that it exists from Africa through to Asia, is, you know, you target immediate threats and you eliminate them militarily. But then you recognize that it's political, economic, and social solutions. It's creating jobs, empowering women, that actually sucks the oxygen out of the room for these extremist groups. And it's going to a lot of our allies and finding new coalitions in the Muslim world of moderate states who will stand up. And they're there. They're ready to go and help us support a moderate Sunni alternative, a moderate Islamic alternative, and turn back the jihadists in just, you know, that one particular thing. But I do think that it also requires a real focus on the deeper threats that I just listed to the U.S. economy and to American society if the president wants to leave with a legacy that has any resonance the day after he's out of office.
So, when he's out of office, what traits might the next president need to adequately handle the foreign policy challenges?
Well, first of all, having some foreign policy experience would help. You know, we do have a Democratic likely candidate, mm-hmm. Hillary Clinton, who would be carrying forward a tradition that existed in the early part of U.S. history but hasn't since the middle of the 19th century, which is having a Secretary of State become president. As Secretary of State, she understands these issues better than you know, almost anybody out there, and so that kind of experience helps. She also ran a 60,000-person part of the United States government, did a good job of it, so that's a you know, kind of a useful set of tools. Having a long-term strategic vision is a vitally important component of this thing, and a good team around them. I think, however, that, you know, we're going to come out of this period, this age of fear, where we swung too far in one direction and then swung too far in the other. And I have a sneaking suspicion that the appetite in 2016 is going to be for something more moderate and more traditional. And that means it could be Hillary Clinton, or it could be Jeb Bush, or it could be Mitt Romney, or it could be Chris Christie, or it could be a number of Republican governors who will bring some management experience and will take us a step further away from this reactive, non-strategic, fear-based kind of approach that has, you know, clouded our judgment over the course of the past 14 years.
Interesting. What about Wisconsin's Governor Walker?
Well, you know, he's somebody who's mentioned in that group of people, mm-hmm. as is John Kasich, as is mm-hmm. Bobby Jindal, as Susana Martinez. You know, there are a bunch of these governors who've run something, who are, you know, sort of middle of the road on a number of issues, not all issues, but on a number of issues, and will appeal to that. And, you know, you can look at this Republican wave the other day that extended into places like New England and formerly blue places, and the people that were elected in those places were not kind of crazy bomb thrower wingnuts, right? They were much more moderate. And so, you know, I personally take it as a more encouraging sign when you see rise in centrist voices, because compromise happens at the center. And the only way we get out of a dysfunctional system and into one where Democrats and Republicans can work together is when they don't view each other either through extreme lenses or as enemies. With some luck, you know, the incredible dysfunction of the past several years, we haven't talked about how dysfunctional Washington is and how broken the Congress is, which plays a big role in this. The American people are disgusted with that, frustrated with not getting their money's worth out of their public officials, and so perhaps we will see a move back. There are a number of signs to suggest it, to people who can work with the other side and do have the experience to actually translate ideas into action.
Thank you so very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
David Rothkopf is CEO and editor of the Foreign Policy Group and author of National Insecurity, American Leadership in an Age of Fear. Thanks to Christy Taylor and to Brianne Chasso for producing and directing this program. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. Much more to come. Tomorrow at this time, it's the Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.